first of all, before I forget, my thanks to the British Council for paying my fare to get me out here and to get me back, to AIP and IEOST and COSA for funding my trip around Australia. And finally, thank you to you for coming to hear me talk about my, well, that's my favourite subject. I suppose it's my only subject these days, because I've, like Frankenstein, created a monster and it rules me now. I speak with some trepidation with people like Dr. Essex here, because I'm going to mention the Faraday and Doppler effects. But you must realise that, first and foremost, I am, or was, a schoolmaster, not a school teacher. I didn't guarantee to teach them anything, but I kept them under control. And I tried to get my kids to have a sound grounding in physics with the fundamentals, and unconsciously get them to learn scientific method, good scientific method. We weren't trying to turn out astronauts and cosmonauts. We were trying to turn out good engineers, scientists. We've even turned out doctors and dentists, one industrial spy. and so long as they did that job well, I felt quite rewarded. In fact, most of them have done far better than their teacher. The educational aspects of a satellite tracking station was the topic I used many years ago at Alexandra Palace for one of the Institute of Physics exhibition lectures, and it was published in the physics education issue from the Institute of Physics, and I'm going to leave a copy of that paper with Professor Cole at the end, because I have no further use for it in Australia, because there's going to be nothing else educational about my trip. But in there are some of the diagrams of the slides that I will use. There's also on the front a flow chart showing how physics and satellite tracking interacts with various other things. In biology, you've got the life sciences, you've got manned space flight. In chemistry, you've got the rocket fuel to put the things up there. And if you look at that, you'll realise that everything is a branch of physics, which of course it is. Now, in 1970, I think it was, we launched our one and only satellite from Woomera. This was the Prospero satellite, launched on Black Arrow. And this was an experimental satellite which carried calorimeters. And these calorimeters here were blocks of copper. And these blocks of copper had thermocouples attached to the back. And they were painted with different sample surfaces. There was a black surface and a gold surface, and there's Crown and Dulux and all the other various kinds of white paint. The idea being trying to find out which would be the right paint to use for the next satellite, which never came along. So this was just put in to show you my sort of philosophy about it, that although all the tracking work and the monitoring work at school was extracurricular, the kids used to work with, they used to come in at school about 8:15 in the morning, and lessons didn't start until 9:00, and they'd operate through the lunch hour, which was an hour and a half, which is just one orbital period of a cosmos. They'd use 3 half-hour shifts there, and they would also work at weekends and in holidays if there was anything really exciting going on. What we did was to milk the space programs as hard as we could for anything which would actually bring the real physics teaching to life. I mean, Leslie's Cube, let's face it, is a pretty boring piece of apparatus, but if you can tie it to something going to the moon or a British satellite, then it has some real meaning. Now, this is where I go into the Doppler effect. The reason I started listening to satellites, apart from the general interest of being able to hear something that I'd been looking at, was that I wanted one recording only to illustrate the Doppler effect on a grand scale in the sixth form. Now, Christmas 1957, I heard a recording of Sputnik 1, recorded by John Osborne at Stowe School, and he played it at the Science Masters Association annual meeting. And I said, "Oh, that's good, John. Will you send me a copy?" And he said, "Yes," and he didn't. So when our chemist died, and the new chemist happened to be a radio ham, G3FOZ, I realised that here was someone with the means to let me listen to something and actually get a recording. And we actually missed the chance of recording Sputnik 3 because we didn't realise it was still transmitting. And the Russians spent the whole of 1959 shooting at the moon, missing it, hitting it, going around the back and photographing the hidden side. And it wasn't until May 1960 when they launched Sputnik 4, the first unmanned test of a Vostok, that we tried to get signals and were successful at the first attempt in about quarter past four in the morning, British summertime. We picked up our first signals. I've known lots of other people who've tried to get satellite signals and have perhaps, in the case of Sven Grahn, waited a year and a half before he got them. I don't think I would have been that patient, but we were lucky, we picked up our signals, and at the end of a week, having survived headlines in the local paper like "Local Men Follow Spaceship," we put the apparatus away and we had the recording, which I will play you now. No, it isn't, it's a different one. Before I go play that recording, let's try and tell you what I think the Doppler effect is. I think it is the change in frequency which is observed by a stationary observer distant from a moving source. Now, the usual thing was to talk about a train going through the station. Well, you get one musical tone of Doppler with a train going through the station. You can bring it up to date these days because trains don't have steam whistles in England these days, and talk about Grand Prix racing. We used to have an earphone connected to an oscillator at a kilohertz and whirl it round our heads on about 6 feet or 2 metres of flex. It's the same sort of thing you get when you're flying control line aircraft and you're outside the circle. You hear the Doppler effect, the man on the inside holding the plane doesn't. Another illustration of the Doppler effect, I don't know whether this is well known in Australia, it wasn't well known in Western Australia. If you get a tap with a thin stream of water coming out of it and you just insert a pinpoint in it, you can actually see capillary waves with short wavelengths on one side and long wavelengths on the other. And that's a visual Doppler effect, and you can actually project it if you put it through the focal plane of a projector. I commend it to you because it's nice to see a Doppler effect. You can also get it if you photograph a swan vertically swimming. You've got short waves in front of it and long waves behind it. However, the man in the song, "The Railroad Runs Through the Middle of the House," gets the best Doppler effect, except he only gets it that far usually. You get a rapid change there. The further you get from the line of motion, the more the Doppler effect gets smeared out like that. And by measuring the time of the point of inflection, you can get a time of closest approach to your ground station. And by measuring the slope at the point of inflection, you can determine the slant range in a straight line. I don't believe in refraction in the ionosphere. The slant range from your station to the satellite. And then, if you believe in Pythagoras and a flat Earth, you can calculate from the height, the orbital period, the height of the satellite, the mean height of the satellite. You know the hypotenuse. That gives you the ground range of the sub-satellite point from your station. You can draw a circle of that radius around Kettering, and you can draw the common tangents to that circle and the line of latitude of the inclination of the satellite, and you've got four possible tracks. And this is the way we found the Chinese launch site when they launched their satellite in 1970, because we waited for the next pass and we then were able to rule out some of the tracks because the Doppler effect was either more or less, I forget now. But I'm a great believer in flat Earth and Pythagoras and non-refraction in the ionosphere. It puts you in the right area. It got us into China anyhow, which is a good thing. The next slide shows another bit of physics. This is from the recording which I will play you of a pass of Cosmos 40 back in 1964. We are now up to Cosmos 1801, and I see John Coleman here, who was there last night. I said that I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Russians had launched on Friday. They did, and they did it on a grand scale. They launched 8 satellites with one rocket for tactical communications, but it took us past the 1800 mark. Down the side here you see drawings of an oscilloscope screen for the frequency measurement. This is another thing that we did at school. We set up a circular time base using a resistance and a capacitor, and we modulated the intensity grid with the signal. Now, if you start at the bottom, if you have a time base of 200 hertz, that goes around 200 times a second. If you put a 200 hertz signal on it, it will suppress the trace for one half of that. You could tell women's institutes and rotary clubs that for half a cycle it's a cathode ray tube and works well, and the other half of the cycle it's an anode ray tube and it doesn't work at all. But you wouldn't tell physics students that, because they might put it in their examination papers. But it does give a very precise frequency measurement, because when the frequency is about 210, this will rotate, that circular arc will rotate clockwise or anti-clockwise according to how you've got it fixed up, at 10 times a second, and it gradually slows down and then reverses as it goes through 200, and then it sort of disappears and goes into a circle. So that is a very precise method of measuring the frequency. And all it needs is an oscilloscope and a signal generator, oscillator. I sometimes play a tape recording with a film, a 16mm film, showing what the oscilloscope trace did. And by leaving it on 200, when you've got a kilohertz of signal, you get five arcs. At 800, you get four arcs, three arcs, two arcs. I don't need to tell you that. This is what it sounds like. And instead of musical tone, you get a whole octave. Starts up here and down there. Not a very good recorder. But we're now starting to come down. I think even a tone deaf person would tell that the frequency's dropping. And of course, when we get here, it's the closest approach to Kettering. That's where Kettering is. Notice that the intensity is not constant. There is fading there. So there we suggest is a very dramatic demonstration of Doppler shift. It's even more dramatic if you've got a receiver in your classroom and you can actually get a signal like that during the lesson. Trouble is, we don't get many signals like that these days. They're usually modulated with information. And I've tried my hardest to get NASA to put a shortwave beacon on the shuttle. It wouldn't be a lot of problem in that, and it could be NASA's gift to the educationalists around the world, because with shuttle flights, as they were, going fairly regularly and not staying up too long, you could have measured the Doppler shift, you could have determined orbital periods, you could have got Faraday fading, all sorts of interesting things. We did try in the early days, we suggested that we would have one of the getaway special canisters and put a shortwave transmitter in it, but NASA said no, nobody's going to transmit out of our getaway special canisters. So I keep working, I keep grinding away at people like Phil Colberts, and I had a go at Charlie Taylor, the NASA representative in Canberra, the other day, but he says he doesn't even get communication from Washington, so I've got great hopes on that one. The next tape recording that I'm going to play deals with the fading that we heard. And that, as everybody here knows, is Faraday fading. This brings me to what I call the interesting part, because I've got the rotten physics out of the way. This is the telemetry from the first Chinese satellite. Repeat. Seconds of propaganda. The Chinese wanted the world to know they'd got it up. They chose a frequency which was only one kilohertz away from the Soyuz frequency. 5 seconds to get its breath back. 10 seconds of silence. 5 seconds to get its breath back. Did that for a month. Were we glad when the batteries ran out? Now, we were very fortunate in picking up the signals from this, the first people in the Western world to do it. I had a phone call one Saturday afternoon, and the voice said, do you want to know about this Chinese satellite? And I thought, it's one of my sixth form having me on, you see. So I said, who is it? He said, Dick Pankhurst, Evening Telegraph. I said, oh, yes, Dick, what about it? He says, it's playing music. I says, what? He said, yeah, I know the frequency. I said, right, tell me the frequency, which he did, 20.009. I said, well, I'll call you back. Now, Murphy's law is that you've probably missed all the passes for about 5 or 6 hours, so I got Mrs. Perry to pack me up some buns and a flask of coffee and things like that, and I put some marking together and took it up to the school, and inside 20 minutes picked this up. 4 minutes before Sven Grahn got it in Sweden, because it came our way first. And we had our recording, like that you heard there, played on the radio and the television news. And because of that, we were invited to the Institute of Physics annual soiree at the Savoy Hotel. And the boys hired their dinner suits from Moss Bros, and we had a very good dinner. And I realised that there were going to be lots of clever people there, people like Patrick Blackett, as president of the Royal Society, and they were going to say, what does it mean? And we didn't really know. So after we'd had the invitation at the physics practical on the Friday, we set about measuring the frequencies of the notes in the tune, because I decoded that with our piano that night, and like this, and we suddenly realised that the key to this telemetry lay in the tune, because the 100% value is the frequency of that note there, and we were still tied up with 32 quantization from our Russian satellites. We assumed that this was quantized in 32 bits, and it isn't. The zero value is the frequency of the lowest note in the tune. Here we have calibration, 0, 100, 0, 50, 0, 100. That is a double-length channel, and the length of one channel of scientific telemetry is the length of one crotchet, one black note. So the key to the science all lies in the tune. If you plot the values of that one, and that one against time, you get three sine waves 120 degrees out of phase with each other. So those particular channels give you X, Y, and Z for the attitude of the satellite. What the other values are, we don't know, but we thought we'd done quite well to get that far. I took a chance and wrote a letter to the editor of Nature, thinking that school teachers never get letters published in Nature, and he published it within about 3 weeks, so I was quite happy about that. The first Chinese satellite looks like that. That is a half-scale model at the Paris Air Show, and show you the other sorts of things which you can do. If you measure the length of the shortwave whip antenna and the length of that spike on there, you can reason that it's going to transmit on 180 megs as well as on 20 megs. And this year, on the 6th of October, by tuning 180 megs, not quite 180 megs, I picked up the signals from the 19th Chinese satellite before it had done two orbits. And we announced that on the Teletext service of independent television as an ITN scoop. Chinese launched 19th satellite. It will be recovered on Saturday. The Chinese didn't announce that they launched it until the 11th of October when they recovered it. So between the 6th and the 11th, I kept getting phone calls saying, is there really a Chinese satellite? And I say, oh yes, if you'd rung 5 minutes ago, you'd have heard it go by. However, by just measuring antennae, you can do some quite simple things, and you can get in resonance and all sorts of other physics like that. The next signal I want to play you is from the second Chinese satellite, which when we first heard it, we tuned out as interference, but later logged as horse's hooves. There's a triple click every 5 seconds. Now, the Chinese are fiendishly cunning people. This thing transmitted until it burned up for about 10 years. And in the pulse duration modulation, if you like to regard them as soccer goalposts, it's the length of the crossbar which is the measure of the word. But what does the crossbar do? It only keeps the uprights apart, so the Chinese just transmit the uprights.
And here's the triple pulse. That's 1, 2, 3. This is the triple pulse every 5 seconds. And actually, these are calibration, because if you look at the unmarked ones, they're equispaced. And they are the left-hand goalpost, or the start of the measurement. The ones which are numbered are the right-hand goalpost and measures the actual duration. This is called pulse position modulation. And I've got a colleague in Malmo who's got remarkable ears. Now, I don't mean that they stick out like Dumbo, but he can hear telemetry changes in those clicks. And he wrote me a letter saying, I think that the telemetry changes when the satellite goes into eclipse. Well, I couldn't hear it, but I got recordings and I played them onto the pen recorder, and he was absolutely right. And here you can see it going into eclipse. If you look at word 5, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, in 15 seconds has suddenly gone to a short value. This is what Janola heard. It upset the rhythm, I suppose. Word 10, 5, 10, 15, 20 seconds goes to a short value. And word 14, is it? No, 13, let's think. Yes, it's word 13. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, about 30 seconds goes to a short value, because they're each 5 second strips. So we said to ourselves, what should we do now? And came up with the idea that we should look for the opposite to happen when it came out of eclipse. But of course we had to wait about 2 months so that we were getting passes over Kettering when the thing exited from eclipse. And we looked, and lo and behold, word 4 went back to its long state, but words 10 and 13 didn't. Well, obviously, they've got to go back somewhere. So we kept looking. And then one day, we saw words 10 and 13 very slowly recovering over a period of about 5 minutes. And this occurred 20 minutes after the satellite had left the eclipse. And it just so happened that day that I realised that it had been in eclipse for 20 minutes. So what happens is this. Word 4 is an optical sensor. When it goes short, it says, I've gone into the Earth's shadow. The brain inside the satellite says, I've gone into the Earth's shadow, I'm going to get cold. I will therefore put my jacket on. So what you see here on 10 and 13, you see the Chinese satellite putting its jacket on to stop itself getting cold. But of course, it does cool down even with its jacket on. When it comes out of the shadow, the optical sensor on word 4 says, ooh, goody, sunlight again, you see. But the brain says, ah, yes, but I've been cooling down for 20 minutes. And I'm not going to take my jacket off until I've warmed up again. And so it waits 20 minutes, and then, even so, it takes its time taking its jacket off. And when we got the pictures of the second Chinese satellite, we were delighted to see the solar panels on it. It's very similar. The difference between this and the other one is that it does have these little banks of solar panels, which is why it was able to transmit for about 10 years. But it doesn't have the active Venetian blind type louvres thermal control. Now, this is rather disconcerting, because we'd written in one of the Library of Congress's reports that it had got active thermal control of a louvre type construction. And it wasn't until Sven Gran was in Beijing earlier this year on business for the Swedish Space Corporation that he actually saw China 2, backup model of it, and was allowed to look inside. And the louvres are on the end of a semicircle channel inside, which contains the electronics. And that's only been referred to twice, in public, once in Perth and today at La Trobe, because inside there you have the electronics all in a semicircular sort of conduit with thermal louvres on the end. But it was nice to see that sort of thing happen. And thank you for listening, and thank you.